I'm Bronwyn Williams, futurist and trained analyst, and this is Local Logic, where we help South Africa's technology leaders unlock the real power of data and AI in their technology stack. Join me as I sit down with Dr. Bongani Andy Mbaso, CTO of Altron Group, on building secure data and AI-driven digital transformation. Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron, because local expertise drives global results. Hello, I'm Bronwyn Williams, your host for Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron. Today, I'm joined by Andy Mbaso, the CTO of Altron, of course, as always. And today, we also joined with Stephen Sidley, a gentleman of many talents, some of which actually date back to the forerunners of Altron itself. But Stephen is an expert in AI for many different reasons, and that's why we brought him along to participate in this conversation about data, AI, and sovereignty. In other words, who owns our data and what we do with it. And to kick us off, Stephen, if you could tell us, what is sovereignty when it comes to data in today's day and age?
Okay, well, obviously, the subject of data sovereignty has predates artificial intelligence by a very long shot. It really has three levers, data sovereignty and the regulations which define it. The first one is it addresses protection and privacy rules and requirements for the people whose data it affects. So those would be, for instance, consumers, and in some cases, corporate data. Now, the second lever is the localization and residency constraints of that data, whether there is a national need to keep it within border walls. And the third one is the access and oversight rules. In other words, who has access to that data? Do you have to give the government or any of the government delegates like law enforcement or security access to those? And where it has ended up today, the modern consensus of data sovereignty is a concept called free data flow with trust. And that has to do with the movement of that data cross-border, because as we know, we live in a global world. And that's sort of the box in which this entire subject sits.
Thanks. Moving on to you, Andy, maybe you want to come in with a few more first principles and also distinctions about what people get wrong or the misconceptions around what data ownership or sovereignty is today. For example, what is the difference between data sovereignty and data residency and data ownership versus data control?
Yeah. Thank you, Bronwyn, as always, for being a great host. And Stephen, it's nice to see you. Look, I think it's always good to go back to first principles, like you've mentioned, just to be clear what we are talking about. And I think Stephen did a great job in terms of defining, what data sovereignty is. I think what we often find in our customer base, you know, especially when you deal with highly sensitive data, perhaps in government, in banks, etc., in, you know, just different environments, people have various misconceptions of what is and isn't data sovereignty. One of the things that I had to, you know, when I was CEO of CETA, we had to, you know, unpack in detail is the U.S. Cloud Act of 2018. And the U.S. Cloud Act of 2018 states that, you know, if for whatever reason law enforcement in the U.S. Decides that they want to investigate, say, an organization that's, say, in South Africa, if they are provided, you know, with data services or cloud services by any of their, you know, American companies, then the FBI or Interpol or any of the American, you know, sort of, arms of state that can, you know, do that level of thing, can actually compel that organization to reveal, your data sets. And so those are some of the things that, if you go and you challenge like a cloud service provider on that, they'll tell you, well, it's true. But they'll give you all sorts of reasons on why that, you know, it's very unlikely to happen. But it is a real risk that actually exists and is out there. And so I think people need to just differentiate, you know, what they mean when they say data sovereignty. For me, I like to see it in three different ways. Data residency is whether the data is in the country or not, and whether there's, you know, kind of reasons for you to keep it there. And I think most of the cloud services providers actually give you that, versus data sovereignty, where you actually have juristic control rather, mm-hmm. Over that data, where no other sovereign state can compile or get into that data through some other means, right? You know, without your consent. And I think if you unpack that in detail, you start to, a picture starts to emerge where you can decide, okay, well, maybe for this level of data, sure, I can use cloud service providers, and you should, right? Because they provide great services. But perhaps for others, I need to look at a different strategy. Data ownership and control, I think, is ultimately what it's about. You know, data ownership is I own the data. I have ultimate control of it. And therefore I can determine what is done and isn't done with it. We live in South Africa and there's papaya. And if you have consumer data, for example, you don't own that data, right? You are a custodian of it on behalf of a consumer. And so you have to make sure that you protect it, and use it in a way that is, you know, in keeping with that, with those regulations. So I think people need to just be very, very clear, you know, what it is that they're talking about and what level of risk they're willing to live with, right? When it comes to data sovereignty.
So basically, you're talking about two layers of control, yes. Company-level control and country-level control, correct. Right? But I want to stick with you before I get back to you, Stephen, just to push you on that a little bit. When it comes to the country-level control, you've positioned it in such a way that one of the risks is falling under the jurisdiction from a legal perspective of a foreign country.
Correct.
But if you are a South African business, what are the benefits actually of remaining within South Africa's control as opposed to perhaps a foreign jurisdiction? We know this is a question, of course, we ask about our finances, right? Do we want it banked here or on a Swiss bank account or somewhere in Mauritius under a trust?
Correct.
What are the benefits of actually operating within our national borders as South African businesses?
Correct. Well, I think one of the benefits, there's many, but one of them, I think, is you know that whatever provider, right, of a data center or some data service that you're consuming as an organization, they are bound by the same laws that you are bound by, right? So at a legal and a country level, the same regulations that apply to you, they also apply to them, and so you can navigate that a lot easier. Versus an organization that isn't necessarily bound by, you know, your country's you know, regulations and rules, etc. So I think those are some of the things that people just need to take into account.
Very valuable point. Stephen, back to you. Do you want to come in here with any further comments? And also, can you add an extra layer of complexity to the conversation in that what does AI change when it comes to this conversation around data ownership and control?
Yeah, I want to stick the knife in here a little bit because I've always considered the concept of thank God I don't work for a corporation anymore, so nobody can fire me. The concept of data residency being in this day and age utterly absurd. There is, if any of you know a gentleman by the name of Willem van Billion, he was the original architect of what became Amazon Web Services. He's a South African. He lives in Cape Town. He went to California and he built this system. It was called the Elastic Cloud or something at the time. Anyway, he made a comment to me. He said that people who think that residency is important do not realize that if you go to Amazon to store your data, notwithstanding the fact that it lives in another country, your actual data at Amazon Web Services is the safest in the world because they have spent $50 billion on perimeter control and encryption, etc. And the whole concept of a residential law or a residential policy does not increase the security of your data. Your data is most secure when it is at the most secure company. At the current time, it would be either in the Google Data Cloud, the Amazon Data Cloud. There is an argument to be made, as Andy said, that you know, should there be a clash of laws between the country that houses your data and your own country, there may be other problems. So I do agree from that perspective, it is quite important. And with that in mind, many of the big cloud providers have started building data sovereign safe data centers. I don't fully believe it because all of those big hyperscalers have to have backup data centers. That's their entire model. If Google or Amazon's data centers in Africa go down under a flood or a bomb or anything else, they are backed up elsewhere in the world. So not even that is entirely true. To the second part of your question, Bronwyn, AI makes has brought a complicating wrinkle into this. And here is the complicating wrinkle. One of the dirty little secrets of AI, which is unknown to most people, even those who use it, is that the data, and let's just use ChatGPT for example, data is not stored. If you look under the hood of ChatGPT, you don't find any data. You find a set of statistical relationships in a matrix. This was one of the arguments that is made by the copyright people. You can't find anybody's painting or anybody's novel inside the data. You just find a set of words and statistical relationships. So if you are building an AI system which is going to use the vernacular language capability of the LLMs in order to be able to chat casually with a user, you are in danger in having all the data about that chat, all the data that's provided as context, being sucked in as training, and it becomes ungovernable once it's pulled in as a training data set. So there is not only a danger, in my view, there is an absolute certainty of data leakage if one is using some of the frontier LLMs. And if you are in the business of doing interaction with AI, you are going to be using one of those LLMs, and there's no way out there's going to be data leakage. Excuse me.
Well, let's zoom in on what you said there, talking about ungovernable data in the age of AI, and then also tying that back to the point you made earlier that your data and your company, by consequence, is safest with the strongest technology that can offer you the safest place to store and manage your data, but also implicitly within the strongest jurisdiction. And there, I know in the preparations to this this conversation, you had made an interesting comment saying that when it comes to a regulatory strength, and again tying in with what Andy said a bit earlier, that perhaps our local born and bred POPIA legislation could in some ways be stronger than GDPR if you're looking at regulatory strength as one of those levers of security that however fallible they could be, are still the key things we can look out for when it comes to protecting our business and our customers.
Yep. POPIA is stronger than GDPR, and it's stronger than GDPR for one very simple reason. GDPR only protects consumer data. It does not protect corporate data. It is not written to their regulation. POPIA protect consumer data and corporate data. So right there, you have a much stronger set of laws in order to oversee that data. It has plenty of downsides as well. I don't know if we'll get into that. But the more that you regulate, the slower and more stuck in sludgy process it is. So there is that to consider. But it is a stronger law. And by the way, the South African law says if you're going to put the data somewhere else, it has to have a set of regulations that are at least as stringent as the local ones. And right there, we've got a problem because it's telling you can't put your data, corporate data, in Europe. And that is negative for many companies.
But not for local South African companies doing businesses with other tech businesses that work on South African shores. Andy, do you want to come in here and just zoom in a little bit on the key choices and consequences thereof that are really becoming explicit based on some of the points both yourself and Stephen have made for businesses in general, firstly, but then more specifically for financial services businesses, where, of course, data protections come with a higher set of consequences and perhaps other sectors of the business world.
Yeah, this is a very interesting conversation because I think, Stephen has raised another point around cybersecurity, right? And how secure, which is a slightly different concept, your data is, right? In whatever environment, right? Whether it's a co-located, environment or not. And I think it would be difficult for anyone to argue that, that hyperscalers have not invested more than anybody else in making sure that security in that environment is as strong as it can possibly be, right? So I think that argument is very valid. However, I think it's a slightly different argument to, around laws, etc., because, any local agency that wants to enforce some particular law, they don't need to go through, some nefarious way to get to the data, right? It's just an official thing that they pass and, they come and investigate, whatever it is that you're doing. So I do think that you do have to consider the entire landscape end to end. Yes, there's the technological risk and how do you secure that? But there's also the geopolitical risk and how do you make sure that you've got the right mix? And I just think, the purpose of this conversation is to raise the awareness. We had a conversation, I think last year, with Investec, and they were talking about a similar thing, right? Which is, yeah, we get the technology risk and how we can minimize that. This is after the CrowdStrike outage that happened last year where, you know, a lot of the world just could not work. You know, banks were offline, airlines were grounded, etc. And that all happened, you know, kind of, you know, in the West Coast of the US, right? Some change that happened, within that organization that had an impact across the world. I think we saw a similar thing with AWS recently where an outage, in some of their data center, I think one of the data centers on the eastern side of the US, went down. And again, many organizations were kind of, down. So I think it raises a whole lot of points around how dependent are you on one particular provider, even one particular sovereign nation to provide you with a particular resource that you need to provide services for your customers. So I think that's all, you know, part of the mix of what everybody has to think about, you know, in making sure that they can secure their environment for their customers and ensure that they comply with their local laws. I do think one is, you know, security. Two is cost. Because depending on the solution that you go with, it will have a very different cost profile. Three is the regulatory environment in which you operate in. For example, there will be various regulatory organizations that would govern certain sectors of the economy, right? Like banking will have its own set of regulators, etc., which will actually levy fines, right? If you don't protect the data appropriately. So that's one risk that, you know, every organization always sits with. I think for me, it's about finding the right mix that balances between the technology, how secure it is, how compliant you can be with the regulatory laws, etc., and finding a nice happy medium that can work for you, depending on what it is that you're doing. I think the LLM one, the point that Stephen made, is probably one of the most underrated comments. One of the things that we've seen is corporates have gone all in using these large public LLMs in production, or even POC, right? For some of their workloads. But the problem with that is data leakage is almost always guaranteed. Actually the best thing for corporates around AI adoption is how do I ensure that I can use a language model or any type of model that's contextual, that's smaller, that's more efficient, and generally runs as close as possible to where your data resides, right? Which is typically in country. Any other model outside of that, you expose yourself to a whole lot of risks. Cyber risks like prompt injection, cost risks, because, you know, these things are charged per token. And so those variabilities in token charges can really be a pain, especially if you're an FSI CIO with a fixed budget for the year. You know, there are also those regulatory risks that I spoke about earlier. So I think, especially now with AI, this has actually increased, those risks. And I think CIOs and even compliance and risk personnel within organizations have to now actually study these things a lot more closer and ensure that they remain compliant.
So you're saying CTOs should pay attention to geopolitics and monetary policy as well as, of course, technological advancements and market competitive abilities.
Unfortunately, they really ever are decoupled, right? They kind of come together. There's a reason why nations, by the way, are building sovereign AI factories. The reason for that, I mean, it's so obvious, right, when you say it out loud, but it's because we don't want a fundamental technology, upon which we depend, to be solely supplied by one sovereign state. I mean, if there was ever a national security risk, there's one right there, right? I don't have to say too much about that.
Well, maybe you can say a bit more about that before I get back to you, Stephen. And that is, what progress is being made in terms of like national data sovereignty or national AI capability in the South African context in particular, but even continentally wide across Africa?
Yeah. So I'll start with the local context. Look, it's still in the early days. It's nascent. One of the organizations that are really pushing for this is the CSR, just as an example that we're working with. To establish a local sovereign capability on behalf of government. And I think other organs of state will join in that. I think it's very necessary. Across the continent, we've seen the investment be 5 years behind where the rest of the world is. So it's something that's definitely catching up. I think there are opportunities for businesses, if they want to move into that space, although that comes with its own risks and challenges. What we've seen, though, in the Middle East has been amazing. I mean, I've just, spent some time in Dubai. They're putting up sovereign AI factories everywhere you can look, right? The USA has obviously been very key to this. China, We know how well documented that is. They're trying to make their own chipsets as well, right? To de-risk themselves from NVIDIA. So I think it's an interesting developing area. We'll see where sort of the chips land. But I think any organization that isn't thinking about this, or even any state that's not thinking about this, I think will reap really bad rewards in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, staying with Andy's amazing pun, where the chips will land, quite literally and figuratively, Stephen, maybe you want to come in on the upside of this conversation. And that is that there is an implicit tension between risk, sovereignty, and innovation. Somewhere within that kind of trilemma, can you tell us a bit about what that tension looks like? And if you have any wisdom or advice for business leaders trying to navigate that tension, what would that be?
Right. Hold that question while I quickly add a comment to what Andy said earlier about the best way to avoid data leakage is to do your AI locally, which you can do. And the way you can do that is there is one of the big frontier models, and I forget which one. I think it's Llama, which is I think it's Meta. It's open source. So you can download the open source software and do it locally with your local data, and the chances of data leakage get massively reduced. But here's the problem. Then you've got to buy GPUs. And now your company budget has enough to buy like 1.5 GPUs, and you can access 100,000 if you go to Amazon or one of the others. So you lose competitiveness if you try to do it locally.
Unless in terms you come to Ultra. We can scale to any number that anybody wants.
You heard what the man said.
Okay. I defer to that. Let's talk about innovation. The truth of the matter is, in a general concept, not even related to data or AI or anything, is that all regulation sits in opposition to innovation. So innovations and inventors do not want to consult rule books. And regulators want innovations and inventors not to harm people, whether it be the state or individual consumers or corporate. They want there to be no harm. So they've got to check up on the innovators and inventors, and that slows down the whole innovation process. So this is the same true for data sovereignty and privacy and ownership. Very quickly get bogged down by submitting to PAPIR rules, which is fair enough if you're a company like Altron or one of the bigger companies that has people who deal with compliance and has a team in place to make sure that you comply to the laws. But if you're a smaller organization, you just ain't got the time or inclination to do this. You've got the time and inclination to try and get around those rules. Secondly, PAPIR has the problem, or at least South Africa has the problem, is that while PAPIR may have been well considered in terms of its intent, its legal intent, to protect consumers and corporations, it has very little policing capability. There are few people out there doing the sort of monitoring and the sort of sanctioning and the sort of suing and fining that would make sense. So the law exists without very much teeth. That's the secondary problem.
Thank you. And Andy, can I put that ball back into your court in that if I am a business leader, I'm going to hear what you're saying and I'm going to say I didn't get to where I am by taking or hearing no for an answer. And that is, if your clients come to you, if I'm a business leader and I'm saying I want speed, scale and security, what advice do you have in terms of the reality of such a request?
Yeah, look, it's a very good question. You know, firstly, I obviously want them to come to Altron. We can give them that advice. We do offer that advice, you know, for a fee, of course. But in all seriousness, I think it's about being on top of, you know, your game, you know, understanding what your company's objectives are. What is that long-term strategic objective of the organization, and how can the technology or the data or the AI organization enable that company strategy? That's the first thing, right? Organizations don't exist for themselves. They exist for a purpose. What is that purpose? And can we ensure that all of these pillars are serving that purpose? That would be the first thing. And by the way, we ask that explicitly when we consult with customers with that, because too often with technology, projects is, you know, when you've spent the 50 million rand or the 100 million rand, and the results haven't been delivered, who gets blamed? It's the service provider, right? Because there must be a scapegoat. But very often it's just about very poorly conceptualized problem statements that are not clear, you know, what it is that you're trying to solve. So we always start there. What are you trying to solve? How does it make your beer taste better? Once we're clear on that, then we go, all right, let's look at the various options that you have around making this a reality, right? We might look at a fully in-source solution within your own environment, etc. What would that look like? Do you have the skills to be able to run that yourself, etc.? You might look at a hybrid solution where, for some things that are very low risk, absolutely use the cloud, right? Because for me, there's, and what Stephen has said, there's a lot of R&D that's gone into that you could, leverage. Or we can go, can we look at a more bespoke solution for what it is that you're doing? So the range of answers really depend on, that first, question that we ask. What is the ultimate objective that you are doing? Of course, there are constraints. The constraints are the regulatory environment, the laws that you have to work within, etc. We need to look at that and make sure that we factor that in, depending on the answer that we look at. If I can say something here, maybe as an addition, right, beyond just the question, I think one of the smartest things that I've seen done in this space is I call them hybrid architects, people that are able to craft the right technology strategies to meet a specific intent, right? So front end, the front end of an application, maybe I don't care so much where that is, and maybe that can sit in cloud. I'm just giving an example here. But the product layer, I really care. And for that, perhaps I want to have sitting in a local data center where I've got active configurations. I can walk over to the data center. If something goes wrong, I can rack and stack it myself. And many of our banking customers actually follow that approach. And then perhaps for the AI, sort of environment, for the low risk initiatives, sure, use whatever is sitting in the cloud. But for the really high risk use cases where I'm dealing with personal information, entity information, then I really want my own local AI factory. So we're starting to see customers move into that direction where they're almost starting to see all of these things as tools in their toolboxes. And then they go, how do I weave a picture together, right, that can serve my purposes? That's what we're starting to see as an emergent approach that corporates are starting to use. And like I said, one of our banking customers has actually followed exactly that, right, which is, we're not anti-cloud. They are our partners, as they are partners of Altron. But for certain things, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to put it in our data center, and that's our policy, And having that clarity of thought, I think, is often what's missing. Because if you don't have an opinion, right, then you get swayed by all opinions. And I think that's part of the challenge, that we see with these things. And so, we can definitely offer that advice and help as Altron to go, okay, let's look at your environment. Let's see what would be the best approach for where you are as an organization.
Do you want to come in there with anything, Stephen, before I get to a slightly softer but perhaps even more important question for you?
No, I would comment that if we use the example of the banks, even well prior to Papia, which was, on-prem versus off-prem, it's an example to me how that sort of thinking does not work, in that the on-prem, and in those days it was simply a matter of security. The people thought that on-prem was safer than cloud, and it wasn't. You can get a teenage hacker to break into a company's on-prem premises. You can't get a teenage hacker to hack into one of the hyperscalers. So the problem is that the regulation moves at a much lower pace than technology. I'll give you another example. A lot of what you're seeing today in terms of the way that compute and storage is being deployed architecturally is moving to the blockchain. As you know, it's not only stablecoins and Bitcoin that's doing that. It's file storage, it's compute. Everything is moving to a distributed world in which the compute and the storage is spread over hundreds to hundreds of thousands of computers. In a world like that, how do you have a national regulation that controls that? You can't. And if you're going to insist on a national regulation, you damage your own ability to compete against those who don't.
Well said,
I realize my view is completely my view is completely Pollyannish and impractical, but I think it is. And of course, corporations like the one that Altron speaks to, their clients have to stick with the law. But in the greater scheme of things, regulation is years and years behind technology, and it is that gap is increasing.
Could I maybe add something to that? We should have a longer conversation, but. I think, with things like blockchain, et cetera, it certainly opens up a new paradigm, right, around how do you kind of manage the risks and govern things, right, in that kind of world. But I think it sticks to the same fundamental principle, though, which is what does the mix look like? And what is the level of risk I'm willing to sit with, given my regulatory, environment, my company objectives, the customers that I serve, et cetera, et cetera. those things are never going to change, right? Like, yes, the technology and how connected we all become, I think that's always going to not change and increase. But the factors that you have to decide on are always going to be there. And so I think for me, organizations, especially now where regulations are so far behind where technology is, have to be more on the ball, right, in making sure that these decisions are made deliberately and not just by kind of default, right, which is I go with what everybody else is going with. I think for me, that's the biggest risk. It's almost apathy, which is, I'm just going to see where everybody lands. And I don't really apply my mind around what makes sense for my organization to balance all the risks. Ultimately, that's what it is, right? How do I make sure I balance all these competing interests and make the best, you know, decision for my organization and my customers?
Yeah, and speaking about making the best decisions, but also coming back to Stephen and his self-described Pollyanna-ish tendencies, there is another question that I wanted to get into with you specifically, and that is serenity from a slightly higher level speaks to both the ability to control and mitigate risk on the downside, but it also speaks to the ability to be self-directed to go after the opportunities that you see ahead. And how does the lack of both capital and human capital, in other words, skills, talent, here in Africa in general and again South Africa in particular, limit businesses on our continent from actually embracing that sovereignty and having that control over our future, not just our present? And to end off, of course, on a more positive note, what are your suggestions to business leaders listening to that who want to correct this?
Right, so obviously we have challenges in both capital and skills, and the reason is fairly obvious in both cases is that both capital and skills are global rivers. And if you are in a local tributary called South Africa, you don't have access to the big river. And the reason you don't have access to the big river is that for many of our government laws, this makes it unappetizing to work in South Africa, and Elon Musk and Starlink is a perfect example like that. The matter of skills is one that is sort of one that's as obvious, but a little bit easier to solve. And I think the best skills, and I'm talking particularly AI, where is the most demand on these skills. The best skills are global over there. There are very, very few skills in South Africa. I'm a professor of practice at the University of Johannesburg. I teach artificial intelligence, and there is a very thin level of understanding of how to do the stuff at a technological layer, which is useful to corporations. So what corporations are doing, as an obvious solution, that is they're hiring contractors from anywhere, off the web, and there are plenty of them, very good AI people. And in order to stay competitive, there is no other way to do that. We may get to a point at some future date where we have enough artificial intelligence skills to build the systems that we require. They're not there now, and universities take a very long time to train people. There aren't even proper curricula at our universities. The only solutions for corporations is to look the other way when they're supposed to be hiring local and to hire from the international pool.
Andy, do you have any last words before we wrap up this conversation on what we can and cannot control?
Yeah, I think the skills challenge is quite an interesting one. I mean, we definitely see the same, you know, kind of challenges. But as Altron, we've taken a very deliberate approach, which is we're going to train our own skills. We will grow our own timber. You know, we've certified over 60 people in AI. I mean, that's my PhD area of research. And so we are very deliberate about making sure we've got the best skills in the country, and we're not backing down on that. I think that Africa is an untapped resource when it comes to raw just intellect. You know, even taking software engineers, right? Like, you know, yeah, sure, we're not maybe the best at producing AI engineers, but we're quite good at software engineers, and we actually export quite a lot of them. And we do bridging courses around, okay, how can we take you and convert you into someone that can work with AI? And start to use your skill, right, in implementing agentic workflows, et cetera. So that's what we're doing. And we're doing that not only for ourselves, but also for our customers, right, because of that challenge that has been raised. I think the research will catch up. I'm still a reviewer in one of the biggest AI journals, Nature. And so I can definitely see the uptake of skills coming from South Africa, and in particular Africa as a whole, right, in specific challenges that affect us, like language, etc. So I'm fortunate to sit in the front end where I see these things kind of happen before it hits mainstream. So I think it's trending in the right direction.
And that's a great place to wrap up this episode of Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron. Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron, because local expertise drives global results.